Welcome to the Perceptive Podcast here at Game Wisdom. I am Josh Beiser, the owner and lead writer. Join me this week, Game Wisdom site designer and artist for Smugby Games, Kenneth Holm.
Hey there.
And returning guest, co-founder of Artisans, Charles Amos.
Hello, everybody.
Hey, Charles. It's great to talk to you again.
Yeah, you too.
Hopefully you had a great New Year slash Valentine slash I forget any other holidays we missed since we last talked.
It was the holiday season.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, pushed out a bunch of updates for Artisans and still had some time for family and friends.
Cool. And how is Artisans going, by the way? Is it still considered alpha, pre-alpha, or anything else?
We're still in pre-alpha. And, you know, for me, that means we're not yet feature complete. Mm-hmm. We're polishing stuff as we go quite nicely. So once we hit feature complete, we'll practically be near a beta version. But we're still getting some of our last features in there.
Yeah, definitely keep me in the loop, so I would love to check it out once it hits beta.
Absolutely.
Cool. And before we get started for real, just want to let everyone know my headset apparently snapped like 10 minutes before the cast, so I got it taped together MacGyver style. So hopefully it will hold, but I don't know if it will affect the quality of my voice or anything like that. Okay, so with that, let's get going with some game news, and I think we got a pretty big one to talk about that happened last week, and that is the closing, or the quote-unquote restructuring, of Irrational Games.
Yeah, I think it's a tragedy. It's one of those great game studios that, you know, people expect, or have received such high-quality games from, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can sort of understand Ken Levine's perspective, since he's been in the business for so long and brought up the Shock franchise and BioShock and made it so big. And I think that for him, he really likes small projects and small teams, and that's why he got into the industry in the first place. I think now he has the freedom to make choices like this, so I can see how he'd be disappointing.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me.
Yeah. And for those of you listening who haven't been following the story, basically what's happening is that after the second Burial at Sea DLC that Irrational promised for BioShock Infinite, the studio will be closed down. Ken Levine, though, will remain with 2K and I believe like 15 or 16 people that he's chosen from Irrational. They will stay and form a new studio that we don't know the name of at this time. And he's basically going to make smaller, more, I guess, focused games with a flatter organizational structure. So he doesn't have like 150 people under him anymore.
You know, hopefully, if you talk about smaller games, you know, Freedom Force was pretty small. He could remake that. They still have the rights. They can do it.
Mm.
Do they have the rights, or does EA own the franchise?
Well, that's actually up in the air. Because I heard that it's just kind of in like, kind of this limbo. So that's why it can't be like, you know, brought back or kickstarted or anything, because there's a lot of weird legality that goes into it.
Yeah.
We had Joe McDonough in last year. He was at Card Hunter, but he was one of the designers on Freedom Force, and he talked about just how tough it was to get the rights to that. And probably the saddest news I think made Ken hurt a little bit was the fact that he talked about Freedom Force 2, which was a colossal failure in terms of sales.
40,000 copies they sold.
Mm.
That's ridiculous. But the game was excellent. It was even better than the first one.
Yep.
And they said that, you know, Ken Levine like went into a, you know, a depression rut for a few weeks and didn't talk to anyone and stayed inside. Because they did put so much passion in that game. And you could tell, because, well, with all that attention to detail, it's amazing. That's just why going back, I sometimes reinstall just to go through a campaign.
Yeah, I need to replay that at some point, too. I got them both on Steam.
I mean, if you're a fan of that kind of, like, you know, tactical games and comics, especially, like, throwbacks like the Silver Age, Golden Age comics, mm-hmm. you will love Freedom Force.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of quality and that attention to detail, that's another thing that I think really sucks about this closing, is that Irrational Games has built such a brand over the years. Like, have they been around for, like, 16, 17 years? I'm not 100% sure.
Something like that, or at least Ken in the capacity that he's worked there.
Yeah. So, I mean, in that time, Irrational Games has built up such a brand and cult following, even back when they were doing System Shock and Freedom Force. They were, I call them, like, one, like, still, like, the old guard developers. They've been around for that long. And to have, you know, all that branding and all that potential just thrown out the window, I think is such a waste.
Well, is it thrown out the window? I mean, he's still working in games, and he's
going
to try to innovate with a new small team.
Mm-hmm. Yep. But the name, though, the actual studio is being closed, so that's gone or is going to be.
At least it wasn't gobbled like all those other great studios that EA does.
Mm-hmm.
I still feel so bad for BioWare. They're still releasing pseudo quality games, but not to the caliber that I was used to. Dragon Age Origins and all those other series.
And
yeah. Sad.
Don't forget about Maxis and you know how great SimCity 5 was.
Or PopCap. PopCap was an excellent indie studio, and now look at Plants vs. Zombies 2. And that huge paywall.
Yep.
Yeah, I really liked a lot of games from OMG Pop 2 before they got bought by Zynga. They had really
great.
Nice multiplayer competitive on their own site.
By the way, I think they also said that Plants vs. Zombies Modern Warfare, is that what it's called? Garden Warfare. I'm sorry.
Whatever.
You know what I'm talking about. First-person shooter, yeah. They said that there's not going to be microtrans in it, which I don't
yet,
know what that. I don't know what that means. Does that mean that it's going to cost $150 from the get-go?
You have to buy every plant for like $10.
Or maybe it is free-to-play, and the initial value is, I don't know. One is, I don't know what they're trying to go for, because we all know that there's microtrans in it. We just don't know how it's going to be in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, how bad. Now, going back to Irrational Games, one question I have for both of you is, what are your thoughts on basically the situation itself? Because last week we've heard pretty much like two different sides from general fans, and this is what I posted about. Some people felt that Ken Levine, you know, is disrespectful, you know, he's the captain abandoning his ship. He's not saving the studio, you know, stuff like that. And then there's people who are happy and they're saying, you know, he's making the best of a bad situation. He was able to at least save some people and that he's still going to be working and basically making the games that he wants to make.
Well, go ahead.
I think, was Irrational Games in trouble at all? I mean, this was not coming from some need to close the studio, correct?
That is where things get a little muddy, because obviously the only people who know for sure what happened at Irrational are the people at Irrational. From rumors and stuff that has been leaked or, you know, anonymous guy reporting, is that the studio ran to a lot of trouble with BioShock Infinite. It was delayed, they spent a lot of money on it, though current rumors that it cost $200 million to make between design and advertising. And I don't know how much it actually sold. But apparently 2K, I don't think they were happy with how long it took and how much money it cost. And some people were hinting that it could have been on Ken Levine's fault, that he was, you know, constantly changing ideas, he wasn't sticking to a plan, and, you know, all kinds of stuff like that. But of course, again, we don't know 100% for sure.
Yeah, and it could even just be from his own personal frustrations with the process, and that he doesn't he no longer likes working on projects of that scale and budget because of all the things that are in the mix. I know that he likes to iterate a lot on his designs and maybe late in the game really change things up. And when you're working on a multi-million dollar project like that, you just don't have that same flexibility. And I think he tried to have it anyway and frustrated people by making those big changes. But I do think that's really important to making great products is having that flexibility. So he'll probably have more of that flexibility now with smaller projects.
Yeah, and speaking about like changes and stuff like that, I think that's one of the things that we talked about on a previous cast, Ken, that BioShock Infinite didn't feel, I guess, like stable all the way through. It felt like some parts felt rushed, some didn't feel really completed in a sense. I think we mentioned, you know, Elizabeth's whole tear system that showed a lot of promise in early footage and demos, and it became this very simplistic feature.
Right.
So the game definitely didn't finish as strongly as it started, I think.
Like an example is, like, you can see Elizabeth, when you're chasing after Elizabeth in one sequence, she's pulling through trains, like a New Year's Eve party, all these really cool things, but when you actually play the game, all you do is, like, hooks. You're like, oh, give me that hook. Give me that sentry, that hook. I guess every universe has the same thing, right? So
an infinite variations of hooks.
Of hooks that you can jump on and sentries that you can pull out. So I think that was definitely a missed opportunity for a lot of weird avant-garde kind of thing, or defense and offense. And I think that the combat really hurt the game in itself, the hyper-violence. And I feel like it was a game that could have been more of an exploratory game. Like in the trailers, there was moments where
You
could avoid people. Like, you could press X to, you know, there's an example. There's one trailer with an execution where you could step in, or you could just avoid it and not, you know, get everyone's attention.
Yeah, it felt like, in the original Bioshock, the world had more of a cohesive feel to it, even though you were still loading to and from each area. But in Bioshock Infinite, it just felt like you were just going in a straight line. Even though you had all the hooks and floating city and stuff like that, it felt like a very constrained and linear experience.
It never felt like a floating city unless you were on the skyhooks. Yeah. When you're on the skyhooks, you felt that you were in the sky, which is great, and you had a sense of speed, which is beautiful. But then, in itself, it felt like they kind of missed that chance. It was beautiful, yeah, but there's moments where you seem to feel like you're in the sky.
Mm-hmm. Now, have either of you played the Burial at Sea DLC yet?
I have not.
Mm-mm.
Yeah, I haven't played either. They said that that sort of brings things back to, like, the Bioshocks, but I haven't heard, you know, anything, oh my god, it's amazing type stuff in either.
Yeah. I heard it was pretty good, actually. And I love noir, so they got me hooked to it.
But yeah, so going back to Bioshock Infinite, again, we don't know, we may never know exactly what happened during the state of that development. If the original version was really Ken Levine's, you know, original design for the game, was this his original design, or, you know, what the hell exactly happened?
I actually have a theory that he threw up his hands eventually because he got a lot of pressure to make sure that they made their money back. Even though he did say on Twitter that it didn't cost $150 million, like rumored, but it still cost in the millions, obviously. So maybe he had a lot of pressure. So he's like, all right, fine. We'll put in some violent combat. We'll stick just, we'll take Elizabeth off the front cover, put in the back, that kind of thing, you know?
Mm, yeah.
Going back to what Charles said a few minutes ago regarding that move to a smaller studio, smaller development team, and having that freedom to change, I think this is something that a good point that we've talked with other developers about who made that switch from AAA to indie, and how they really enjoy having that freedom of being able to basically say, I want to make the game that I want, and I don't need to listen to focus groups and a publisher holding, you know, all my money ransom. And it will be interesting to see just what Ken Levine will be able to do now with this smaller studio. Will he make, like, big games? Will he make, you know, smaller, maybe like $5, $10 games? We don't know.
What happens if he just makes Oculus Rift games? How do you feel about that?
That'd be awesome. It'd be quite a change of pace. But he does say he wants to focus on a new kind of narrative. He really wants to focus on narrative in games. Yeah. And he's, you know, done a lot of first person. Oculus seems like a great fit.
Hey, they're doing a lot of weird things with the Oculus in terms of, like, experiences. Like, there's someone's making a 360 degree movie for the Oculus. And don't forget, when you're you know, in an Oculus and you have a narrative experience, you can look all around you. You're not, like, set. No one can control your head, you know. You can turn around.
And that does seem exciting for Ken Levine's kind of stuff. He likes to tell those stories that take place in environments, not just on stages.
Mm-hmm. He did say that really weird expression. He wants to make infinitely replayable, narrative-focused games.
So, and roguelikes. That sounds all the time, just roguelikes.
Which is so different. You know, like, he makes, arguably, very linear, one-time playthrough games. There's a bit of choice in there, but I don't feel compelled to play through a second time to get a unique experience. At best, I'm going to see a new angle on the same story, or it'll become richer, which is certainly worth it. I mean, most of the narrative media we consume is linear and rich on a second watch or listen through. But yeah, that does seem like a big change. I wonder if he's frustrated with the narratives he's written that he... I think games, a goal of a great game is that it is infinitely replayable. It just as its core, but now that we have such narrative-based games, they've become a lot less replayable.
Mm-hmm. And people have described Ken as, you know, very much like an artist or on the creative side of things. So you may be right, having that rigid guidelines or saying, you know, we need to make this so it at least earns $150 million, that could have, you know, eventually caused him to snap a little bit.
To forget maybe all the haters, all the critics, you know, talking about, you know, all his story having a twist, or, you know, or, like, I guess people sometimes, someone, I think I heard someone comparing to Shyamalan, which is not fair at all. It is unfair.
Oh, dear.
That's not even close. but, I mean, maybe that kind of got to him, too, you know? Because there was, you know, there was a level of love for Bioshock Infinite. There's also a lot of hate for it in the vitriol because of that disparage between the gameplay and the story. Or how people kind of overhype the story. And when you do that too much, then you get, like, backlash from people, too. So.
Yeah. Now, another part I want to talk about before we move on is the other news from 2K, and they're saying that they want to continue the BioShock brand. Obviously, even though Rational Games is closing, they own the rights and the IP. So, do you guys think that BioShock could become an annual series?
Well, BioShock 2 happened, so BioShock Infinite 2 is going to happen too, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, they've already set that precedent. I know BioShock 2 wasn't very well received, but, you know, sometimes things like this, when there's a bit of a vacuum where people want a new BioShock, right, but there's no Ken Levine to fill that in, there is that possibility that some new group that we haven't heard of, some new artistic director steps in and gives us a really fantastic experience. So there is room for excitement. I think we're all a bit jaded because we've played so many poor sequels, and we've seen the great artist go away. Oh, and then his franchise languishes. But there are times when the franchise really bounces back because it gets this someone who really loved the BioShock games and is incredibly talented at what they do in the game industry, taking that and sort of bringing it back to its roots or reexamining it in a new way. It could even be something that Ken himself couldn't do.
Yep. Now, a quick tangent. The studio who made BioShock 2, I think that was 2K Marlin, are they still around? I think they went on to do The Darkness 2, but I don't know if they're still around or if they've closed at this point.
Didn't a bunch of the devs leave and make Fulbright's company that made Gone Home? Or was that Minerva's Den?
I'm not sure. It looks like they made the Bureau, XCOM Declassified.
Yep.
So that was pretty recent.
Or we should say they got dumped a stinker and they had to polish it as best they could.
Oh, it's did like... they not start development on that?
No, it was originally, I think, by another studio. This was back when it was called XCOM. And that pissed off everyone wanting a real XCOM, which ironically then led Firaxis to say, hey, we won't make a turn-based XCOM.
That did.
And that's how Enemy Unknown came
from. So I guess they did a good thing by being the evil one. Everyone hated that XCOM so much, there was a new demand for the original XCOM. And I played the game and I loved it. I still love Enemy Unknown.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fantastic.
Yep. Though going back on what you said before about sequels, I feel like they're just being like a realist. I think the sequel can be made and it'll be adequate, because I think BioShock 2 wasn't a bad sequel. It just wasn't a great sequel. It was just kind of underwhelming, similar to how I feel about Batman Origins. It's not a bad Batman game. It's just it's already been done and it's been tired and stretched out. It just feels unnecessary. So
yep. Now, from what I've heard people describe the BioShock 2 about, was that they talk about how the gameplay was better than the first one, but the story just felt tired. Like, there wasn't a need to tell the story. And I think that's sort of what pissed off a lot of people.
Especially if they come to the game looking for the same story or narrative experience from the first one, and they're not looking necessarily for incredibly innovative gameplay. Because the first BioShock is sort of a tight package. It doesn't have poor gameplay, but its gameplay itself is not as innovative as how it interweaves that with narrative.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I think we're about ready to move on. Do you guys have any like final thoughts or final topics you want to bring up about Irrational Games?
Well, I wish Ken luck, and I hope to see what he produces. We haven't seen many game development stars go off to do their own thing and come back to us with a game yet. You know, a lot of people are trying it now, and sometimes their projects get Kickstarter or whatnot, but I wish I had a longer list of people who've done what he's trying to do and succeeded.
And Ken, do you have anything?
I expect good things. I mean, he's a smaller team. He has more room to be creative, so I'm excited to see what he's going to actually turn out.
Cool. All right, so let's move on and talk about some other news. Charles, Ken, either of you want to go first?
I don't really have any major news. I guess the guy that made Candy Crush is now backing out of his trademark. Probably comes from that barrage of hate that he got.
Yep.
Yeah, and it looks like the company that owns Candy Crush, King, is going for an IPO, just like Zynga did. They've been so successful with that, honestly, with that one game, that they are doing a public offering of their stock.
That sounds like a horrible idea. I mean, good for them, but I guess horrible for any investor.
The only reason it might work out for them is... the reason it didn't work out for Zynga in the long run is because of the hype and excitement. And so now their stock is worth, I think, like 50% of what it was in the initial public offering. So maybe now with a company like King, investors, excited investors who want to get in on this, are more realistic about what is this company actually worth? What can we expect from the company's growth over time? Is this really just Candy Crush Saga, or do they have a company formula that can continue to pump out great games?
The answer is, to me, the answer is no. I feel like it's a passing fancy, and for them to do it is, again, if an investor wants to invest in that thing, go for it. But I think it's not a stock that will do well.
I think the other factor is the fact that, as we said, Zynga has already done this, and you know they've been having this huge, you know, upswing and downswing. There have been months that they're having big success, and then they close 5 studios, and then they're trying to get gambling rights. Have they achieved that yet? Are they able to make gambling games?
I don't think it's passed. I actually worked with a client that wanted to do something similar by getting on that, because think about it. What's one of their top games? Is poker, isn't it?
I think so. Slots?
I think it's either one of those two are huge, and as soon as they get the rights for, you know, legal gambling online, then they're going to make hand over fist money, so their stock will probably skyrocket if they get passed through. But there's a lot of hurdles, and I think what they're doing right now is they're passing that law state by state.
Yeah, and as we just said, can King really, like, do that, or do they even have the business aptitude to, you know, expand this to be more than just a match 3 game?
I mean, King's been around for a while and been a big player in casual games. I think they'll probably be able, if they wanted to get into gambling online, I think that they could do it and probably be quite successful. Zynga, I'm sure, is getting there as well. And because of that, I don't think they'll find a lot of immediate competition. They've proven that they can eat Zynga's lunch, as they say, by putting out a game at a good time, at a good, get their microtransactions all correct in order to steal customers from Zynga. Because often people are only addicted to like one or two casual games at a time and then just churn those two. So they're very likely to leave something like, you know, Cityville or whatnot in order to play a King game.
Right. And again, I mean, they're just playing their own tricks against Zynga, you know? They're doing exactly what Zynga does. They copy a game that already exists, they put a skin over it, and hope for the best. And that's what Candy Crush is to me.
Yeah, in some ways, it's not really a game company. It's not a game development company as we know them, where it's like, oh, it's about this creativity, and each one's different, and the reason we are excited by them is when they come out, what's this one going to be like? What are we going to learn? What are we going to be challenged by? That's not what these companies do. These companies are made to give you a little bit of fun and achievement in a way that you've already done. You know, they'll make Tetris, they'll make Snood, they'll make anything over again. But wrap it in such a way that's exciting and new feeling, and really slam dunk the microtransaction business model. And I would say really try to take advantage of people's darker emotions of greed and jealousy and
impulse,
and convert that into dollars, and they've proven that they absolutely can do that, and they can do it consistently.
Yeah, I think we said this on a previous episode. I think it was either last week or the week before, and that the difference between like a good independent company and these guys with the heavy monetization is that the indie guys want to make a game because they feel strongly about it, or they feel that the design can work, while someone who's interested in monetization only is pretty much only making the game for pure profit. They don't care about design. They don't care about building a fan base. They just want to make as much money as they can and then, you know, get out and move on to the next game.
Yeah, or to put that another way, they do care about design and they do care about building a fan base, but in order to make a whole lot of money.
Yeah.
Right.
It's like that's the focus is when I'm making a design decision, what is my reason for that decision? What's my optimization? Is it for appealing to the most number of players? Is it to keep their flow state high? Or am I like trying to say something or shake up the industry or do something new? That usually seems to be the difference.
It's just art perverted, right? It's like, you know, a traditional artist versus a graphic designer, right? You know, a traditional artist makes art just for the pure of expression, while a graphic designer is to make art into function, and usually it's for function for something, for some commercial reason. And in the end of the day, like, you do have some interesting pieces, but they're all commercial, so it feels a bit hollow, you know? It's not really you as much as it's you advertising for someone else.
I suppose, but it's like, I mean, the games we love that aren't, you know, Candy Crush or whatever, are still totally commercial games. We said we loved XCOM, but
that's true.
Totally commercial. You know, it's not exactly like the the Matisse of the gaming world. That would be something like that's free to play, it's free, no microtransactions at all, and it's very artistic and all that.
Well, I was talking about that you guys had the comparison of indie versus these companies. So
all right, that's
what I meant, not just games in general.
But even still, I feel like indie projects like Fez and Super Meat Boy and all those, if you still consider those indie, I don't know if they fit the definition anymore, but are definitely commercial products as well. I guess what I feel is that you can make a game that is about your creative expression, and it is about fun and appealing to as many people as you can, and it is about making some money because selling at the right price point, and that enables you to then make more games later. I think that is good, but you have to sort of strike that balance. I'm certainly not interested in making games totally for free because I just won't be able to make that many games, and my budget for them would be so low, I wouldn't be able to express that much. And I'm definitely not interested in expressing almost nothing, just making like a Tetris clone and throwing as many microtransactions and like getting data analysts to look at the flow of my players and be like, oh, we can take advantage of them here. Yeah, that's, you know, so I think it's more about that balance than necessarily an either or.
Yeah, because you can, there's a lot of marketing campaigns that do creative things with their products and vice versa. So, I mean, you can still have fun with it and monetize at the same time. Just have to, just like in all things in life, moderation.
Indeed.
Yeah, I think when I had Ian on from eRepublic Labs, who they make free-to-play and mobile games, he said that their goal is to make a game that's going to attract someone to the game without spending money first, and then, you know, hopefully get them with some basic monetizations, not design the game to be heavily monetized and, you know, go after the 2 or 3% whales who will buy everything.
Right.
I still think League does it pretty well, their free-to-play model. Because everything can be earned through time, and it seems, and you can gain the points pretty fast. It's just that the skins are things that cost money, and they don't seem expensive at first, but when you put two or three skins, then you're starting to spend some major cash. But again, I think the game seems pretty fair. But you get invested in it, and it has that social connection to it, and you spend not because of just for yourself, but because of the community. I think that's why that game's successful.
And the fact that it's very appealing to people because there is that complete and very complicated game there. It's not like something like Candy Crush or Farmville where you're just clicking on tiles for 5 hours. This is a game that's built its very own, you know, competition. We got
esports.
Exactly. So, I mean, there is a lot of value there, and a lot of it you don't need to spend 1 cent to get into it. Now, of course, you know, if you're going to go into competitive play and you're going to need, you know, 10 or 12 champions that you're good at, then, yeah, you're going to need to spend money. But if you're playing at that level, then you've probably already invested, like, dozens or even hundreds of hours at the game to begin with, which you could have played for free.
Right. And by the way, if you want to get 10 or 11 champions, you can just spend time and not have to pay any money still. Because it does take time to actually get good at that game. So by the time you get actually good at the game, you'll have that amount of champions.
And it's a game that they've continued to support. So it's not like a lot of these social or mobile games where, you know, it's just fire and forget. If it succeeds, great. If it doesn't, we'll just move on to, you know, Farmville 3 or whatever.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see the current state of Zynga and how they're doing with, you know, their following stocks and their new CEO, which is the old CEO of Xbox. Was that
interesting?
Is that true? He left the company. The guy that was all like, he just had so many misquotes during that E3 demonstration of the Xbox, saying that anyone that wants to play Xbox 360 games should just buy an Xbox 360.
Oh, jeez.
And it's insulted every single person.
We have a product for them. Yeah.
Yeah. You remember that quote? Hilarious. But as soon as it was over, he just left the company and joined Zynga as their new CEO.
And he even, like, took that and I think he made, like, a presentation about, you know, how people were angry at him and negative response.
Yeah, I remember a hilarious comic where you see him, like, on a ship and it's starting to sink. He's like, screw you, suckers. And he jumps off and he jumps onto another ship that's on fire. That's Zynga. That was hilarious.
So I think with that, Charles, you said, did you have any news you want to bring up?
I'm excited for Dark Souls 2. It's coming out quite soon.
Oh, yes. I know a lot of people on my friends list who are waiting for that.
Yeah, an interesting point about Dark Souls, I don't know if this is true for the second, it was certainly true for the first, that connects with BioShock and AAA games these days, is Dark Souls had a pretty small budget. It wasn't one of these like massive millions of dollars. And so they made a lot less money than something like, you know, BioShock Infinite, a lot less revenue, but had much higher profits because they spent less making it. And I really, really hope, I think to someone like Ken Levine, that might not seem possible. But I would love to see that be the future of our games industry, is none of these games where they overspend and then it underperforms, even though it sold millions and millions of copies. And everyone loved it and it got great reviews, but they don't make the profit they're looking for. I think Dark Souls shows you don't have to spend that crazy money.
Yep, and as another example, that's what Atlus has done so incredibly well over the last decade, making like the Shin Megami Tensei games, Persona, they're also a localizer. They stick mainly in the AA market, and they know their games aren't going to compete with, you know, Mass Effect or EA, but they make enough to basically get a profit. As you said, they don't spend, you know, millions and millions of dollars on development and advertising. I don't think I've ever seen a Shin Megami Tensei game on TV.
Nope.
That would be actually freak a lot of people out, I bet.
Yeah.
But they make enough to get a profit. And as you said with Dark Souls, that's another great point. And the same thing with Demon's Souls. Demon's Souls was a game that it was very under-advertised. I think most people didn't even hear about outside of, you know, word of mouth. And I think it got like a 98 or something from Famitsu. And that just, you know, swelled and swelled. And then when it was finally released over here, you know, people bought the hell out of it just on that word of mouth. And it didn't need, you know, advertising and magazine and online ads and all that.
I think it came at the right time, you know, because a lot of people complain about how developers handhold too much, like way too much. Like every button needs to be described. This game was pretty ambiguous, and it's the way they told its narrative was a little different too. It wasn't as in your face. It was more like wild texty, but it was still wasn't like cutscene.
Yeah.
And it was really all about skill. And, you know, it was just a brutal, brutal challenge that you had a lot of satisfaction if you actually succeeded in your quest.
And a lot of neat new ideas in a way to reimagine how to make a game that's not multiplayer but does take advantage of the fact that currently while you're playing this seemingly single-player game, you know, thousands of other people are doing the same thing and we're just ahead of you and died. Like, how can we somehow capture that? And without having to make the whole game sort of an open world MMO or something, isn't there something we can do in the middle? And they made a lot of really creative choices. And I think that spirit of that they did take risks, but those risks didn't cost tremendous amounts of money. And they also didn't have a lot of money on the line, so they could take those risks, really appealed. Obviously, it's not as though Dark Souls 2 is going to steal some of the King market or the Zynga market. It obviously is very core and appeals really just to that core market. But talk about a product that really nails the market they're going for.
Well, the message system I always think is just more trolly than I've seen than actually helpful.
Oh, yeah, it's super trolly. But like even that
it's hilarious,
fun, right?
So
yeah,
fun,
like you see the mark right next to the edge of the cliff and it says jump. And you're like,
yeah,
I don't, is that true or not true? It's like maybe there's a secret down there. The world is big enough that could be the case.
But of course, obviously it isn't. You just jump to your death.
Yes, and chances are you see a blood stain right next to it of the guy who did jump. And that's what makes it work. And of course, the voting system. It's just those are really simple ideas and concepts that I think help make something like the Souls games not just these throwback core nostalgia trips for the core audience. I feel like a lot of times when developers try to appeal to the core audience, they try to appeal directly to nostalgia. Indies do that a lot because it's easier with fewer resources to do that. But I felt like something that Souls did, obviously way more resources than an indie, but it didn't specifically rely on nostalgia, but still captured what it is that core gamers love about games.
I think the whole Let's Play phenomenon also helped Dark Souls, Demon's Souls a lot, because there is a lot of trollololos kind of setups to me in the game that I've seen. And
yeah.
it wouldn't be as impactful, at least memorable to me, if I didn't see it on a Let's Play first.
Interesting.
And then there's like people who I watch like Let's Plays of guys who like beat the game with like no armor on or barely stayed at
It's
level
crazy.
Runs.
I'm just thinking, you know, those bastards, how the hell did they do that?
Yeah, and what it highlights for the person watching is how much it is about skill.
Definitely. Okay, so I think with that, let's move on and talk a little bit about some games we've been playing. And for me, I've been playing Bravely Default, and this is the pseudo spiritual sequel to Final Fantasy: The Four Warriors of Light. This was a Game Boy Advance title from, I think, like four, or actually a DS title for like 4 or 5 years ago, and it was pretty much Square Enix trying to get back to the older Final Fantasy style. So no 20-minute cutscenes, no massive stories that make no sense. It's basically four kids trying to save the world, and they also had this really interesting job system where you put on different hats or crowns and they gave you special abilities. So Bravely Default is the game. It's done by the same team from what I've heard, and it's pretty much them taking those mechanics and that design a step further. The combat system, which is really interesting, revolves around using what's called brave points, or BP. You use one BP for any action, and you can use default or defense to basically pull your BP points. So what you can do is you can store up to three, and then you can make four actions in a single round of combat. And you can actually do that as long as you have one point remaining. But if you go into the negative, then that character can't respond until their BP recovers. So it gives the combat sort of like this flow to it that you won't see in traditional turn-based strategy games. And the job system, which is sort of like the upgrade of the crown system, you basically can dual class your characters with any of the unlocked classes. So they're one class, but they can use the skills and the commands from any secondary class. So it presents some really interesting synergies when you start combining like the knight's ability to wield two-hand weapons but do more damage with a high offense character like the Valkyrie who uses a two-hand spear. And then there's all kinds of crazy combinations on that front. The main problem that I have with Bravely Default is that it still feels somewhat rooted in that older JRPG design. You know, like how ailments don't work on bosses. So they can poison, stun, and doom you, but you can't do the same to them. And it also has a very weird, I guess, stats system of how your statistics affect your characters. In how I've had cases where 10 points more of defense or 10 more points of offense would make a boss fight go from being ridiculously impossible to easy to the point that I actually beat the guy in one complete round of combat. And I'm not joking on that. I literally pulled up all my BP and in one turn, I took out like 50,000 points of damage off a boss just from, you know, overwhelming force. So it doesn't really explain those systems well. And the other thing which is weird, and this actually goes back to what we were talking about with monetization a few minutes ago, is that the game actually has a microtransaction, which is very weird when you talk about from a single player RPG. You buy these drinks that allow you to make an action at any point during a battle. So if, like, let's say a boss is about to do his grand super attack, you can stop time and then maybe heal everyone. So you get those points from leaving the 3DS in sleep mode, or you can spend, I think it's like $1 a drink to use it, but it's completely unnecessary. But still, it's pissed off a lot of people who, you know, the second they see microtransaction, they know, you know, grr, it's evil and all that. But it's an interesting game. It's not, I would say, on the same level that I love from like Etrian Odyssey and those types of RPGs, but I think it's a great, I guess, sort of half step forward in terms of JRPG design. And Square Enix has already announced that they are working on a sequel, or a sequel's actually come out in Japan, so hopefully it shows that you don't need to rely completely on, you know, the tired old JRPG conventions to have a sale.
Yeah, I heard a lot of good things about it. I mean, and I think the release of the Dutter Final Fantasy 13 has probably helped the sale of Bravely Default. Because I believe they just released 13.3, which is Lightning Returns.
I don't even know what the hell is going on in that game.
So
I
I
think it
believe.
is the end, though.
That's
I think
it,
that was
yeah.
the end of the trilogy, thank goodness.
Well, the thing is that I heard that the combat was actually really good. But I heard the story was way even worse than before. Even worse. How is that possible?
I know.
Even worse than before.
And yet, you know, they're working off of that same universe that's just broken. So
it was already bad, so they're just making it worse, you know?
And probably trying to wrap up all the ridiculousness. It just makes it more ridiculous.
I heard it looks worse than the other games, too. I did see some screenshots of just some polygons just, like, shoved to another one. I'm like, well, that's not... I don't even know. Who did this?
Complain that they made Lightning's breast bigger for this one. Like, they made her more bustier.
Great.
I didn't see that, but...
That's why I play games.
It is a dress-up game, though. I mean, it's kind of cool. I mean, it sounds silly.
Final Fantasy X, too, right? That
it's a dress-up game, yeah. But 13, the dress-up game, even though it is a dress-up kind of game, it does function because different stats, different abilities with everything you change, and you can change your job mid-combat. And a lot of it's not the gambit system. It's a system where it's all about like attack, defense, and reaction. It's more action RPG-ish.
Yeah.
I heard it's way more successful because of that. And there's a lot of balancing and different kind of things you need to do to bosses to actually be successful.
But of course, for those of you who remember, to get to that, you have to spend like 20 hours playing the tutorial in the original Final Fantasy 13.
Well, that's different. I just hate people that said, oh, well, don't worry, 13 will be good, and like, just have to spend 20 hours, and then it gets real good. I'm like, 20 hours?
That
is, and first of all, 20 hours is ridiculous. Second, if a game takes 20 hours to get good, that's not a good game at all. That's Stockholm Syndrome. That's what that is.
And speaking about dressing up, I almost forgot. Bravely Default did run into a little bit of controversy. They had to edit out some of the costumes that the characters would wear because they were too risque. And I saw some of it online that people were posting. And it's kind of weird. It's like pretty much like S&M gear. And these characters are supposed to be like 14, 15-year-olds.
So didn't they, in the American one, they changed it to 18, didn't they?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But they're actually 14 in the game, yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of weird when you think about that. And with the game itself, one of the things I do like about Bravely Default is that the story, it's, you know, the same old, you know, four guys save the world, that. But they actually have a lot more, like, darker stuff in, like, the side quests. In order to unlock a new job, you basically have to kill the master of that job, or the current head guy. So to become a samurai, you have to kill, you know, the best samurai in the world.
Messed up.
And these are characters who, there's no, you know, changes of heart or, you know, 20-minute speech about, oh, I should have been a better guy or whatever. It's, you know, you're a bastard, die, and you're dead now. Let me get your clothes and I'm going to become a mage.
It's like Highlander.
Yeah, there can be only one.
Jeez.
Yeah, like, it gets disturbing because one of the stories, like, the red mage is pretty much a womanizer who kidnaps women. And like, no redemption for that. There's no, you know, he's going to change his way and be a great man. No, you're just going to finish him off.
Just keep being a jerk. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting, though. I feel like Final Fantasy, I think that game is the good that it's being made, that they can still make games like that. Because I think a lot of people have lost faith in Square, specifically because, I mean, while Western Front, they went on for, like, more developed gameplay and mechanics and more experimentation. Mm-hmm. I feel like Japan went for graphic fidelity. Right? Final Fantasy, Spirits Within.
Especially like traditional JRPG developers. So Square Enix, I'm trying to think of a few. Well, pretty much, I think as you said, that's sort of where Square Enix has gotten a negative reputation from, because they're considered like the epitome of JRPG design and all the good and all the bad that entails. If you look at someone like Atlus, while they're still considered JRPG developers, they go for a lot more interesting things. There's a lot more style to their games, like when you see in something like Persona or Shin Megami Tensei 4.
Well, don't forget, another problem is the gigantic cycle. 6 years, 8 years for one game to come out, that's too extreme. And then, you know, again, games like 13 and Final Fantasy 14, which was, I wouldn't even go into, but everyone knows my feelings on 14. But because of those companies, like, you know, Tomb Raider seen as a failure because they're hemorrhaging so much money. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a bit unfair. Mm-hmm. But as I said before, like, they went for graphic fidelity. And then don't forget, I feel like, I don't know if it's Kojima's fault, but just the cutscenes. How did it come to this? How did it come to 80 hours of cutscenes? Of really bad voice-acted, like, animated cutscenes. Why?
It's because he wanted to be a filmmaker.
Oh, well, I know that. I'm talking about how did Final Fantasy get into it? How did Square start doing it? Why did they do it?
Final Fantasy VII, cutscenes are what made it sell so well. And I think they never got the message that that is no longer true. And they're like, all right, we are now the awesome-looking cutscene game franchise. Yeah.
And I will say this about Square Enix, and I said this before, is that I love it when they decide to go off the rails. When they just decide to say, you know, yes, screw it, I don't want no more, you know, tired Final Fantasy, let's make something completely different. And, of course, that led to The World Ends With You, which is, like, my favorite game from them, which, of course, they now said they're never going to make another one to. So
yep. It's
I'm
too
sad
risky.
Again.
Too risky. I feel like, just like with the Ken Levine and Irrational Games, I feel that when you have such a high budget, you also have a lot of high expectations, mm-hmm. right? And I feel like they kind of shoehorn themselves into a bad position with their 100-some-plus million-dollar Final Fantasy games and the gigantic cycles, right?
Yeah.
They have to make sure it's a success. They have to get their money back. They can't take risks. It sucks.
It does. They got to be pumping out the games a little bit more often. Smaller budgets, smaller teams, greater risks. Do their own little bundles, right? I mean, the Steam is showing us that people will pay a ridiculous amount of money over time and buy a huge amount of games and give essentially more money to those companies than, you know, to shell out that one $60 purchase is a big investment. But I think we all pay way more than $60 in Steam purchases in a short period of time.
This is a bit random, though, but what do you guys think about the Stick of Truth being $60 on Steam?
Ludicrous.
I'm going to bring that up next, too.
Why 60?
I would say that, but I would be. I am tempted to actually look into that game at some point.
I want to buy it, but I don't want to buy it for 60. I'll buy it for 50. I'll buy it for 50. I don't want to buy it for 60.
Yeah, why is a PC game $60?
$60, right.
It could just be that there are definitely people out there who will pay 60.
Yeah.
And it will not be 60 for long. And then it'll be 50 and you'll buy it. And then it'll be 40. Yeah, and it'll keep going down, and then, you know, in a couple of years, maybe just a year, we'll see it in a spring or a summer sale for, like, $1, and it's part of a package.
No, it won't go down by to $1, but... watching all the videos, I really do want to play it, just because not only does it look like it's a good South Park episode, but it looks like a really good JRPG, like a RPG in general.
Yeah, I think that's...
Very aware.
Right there is why they're going to charge $60 for it. Because basically, all they have to say is you play a South Park episode as an RPG. I think there's probably enough South Park fans who will throw money at that, you know, without second thought.
Well, people argue that it's the opposite because they feel like the people that like South Park and the people that love JRPGs aren't even in the same room. Like, they're like separate universes. But the same.
And what's even weird, it's done by Obsidian, the guys who normally make Western RPGs. So it's a Western developer making a South Park game that's like a JRPG.
Well, I actually have faith in Obsidian. I like anything they make, even if they're buggy as hell, but I love it all. I love it all.
Yeah.
I really love Alpha Protocol. It was on sale recently for $380. I was thinking about buying like 100 copies and sending it to people. But I love that. I love those games. I just feel like they always get like a short end of the stick. A lot of the deals they get.
Going back to Bravely Default for a second, one thing that I'm really curious about is, as we were just talking about, in terms of being able to succeed with a smaller development team, a smaller budget, I am curious as to just how big or how much they spent on Bravely Default. Because I don't think this was pretty much Square Enix's A team. It could have been like their B or C team. Because these were the guys who made the Four Warriors of Light, which it did okay, but it didn't really, you know, wow everyone. I think it came and pretty much went after like a month or two.
So if their A team is making 13, they need to be fired, and B team is being charged.
Mm-hmm. Well, didn't the guy who make Final Fantasy, let me see if I get this right, Final Fantasy 11, was that the MMO or the more
single? That's the MMO.
Yeah, that one, 11, I think that's one that I played that I liked. Didn't he, like, get fired, or he, like, left the company halfway through or something? Like, because they weren't letting him do it?
Making 14?
No, it was 11 or 12. It was, like, a single-player one that came out.
That's 12, right?
Okay.
11 is the MMO.
It's so confusing sometimes with the Final Fantasy.
It's the first MMO.
Yeah.
11 and 14 are the MMOs.
All right. So
they made three MMOs, because 14 got eliminated for Reborn. They redid.
Yes, Reborn.
fired everybody, destroyed the world, made the game again.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it will be interesting to see, like, people are worried now. Now they're saying that they're making a sequel already, if it will be able to have the same standard. Because I don't think Square Enix could really do an annual series. Imagine annual Final Fantasy games. That would just be insane.
No. They can't. They shouldn't. I don't want to think about it.
Well, what do you think of something like Borderlands 2-style DLC that comes out quite often, or it did for a while? And that Final Fantasy doing something along those lines. It's not an annual full game, but it's just more updates to existing games or a game that they update more often.
I don't know. It's like
it's in their culture to do that.
It's strange because it's like it's a narrative based game, similar to like it's kind of weird for BioShock to have DLC. It has to be like an offshoot kind of thing because it wouldn't work if it was the case. Because how can you like? I guess they could add in between certain sections, but I still don't see it selling that well unless the story was that interesting. Which
yeah, and they haven't proved that they can make interesting stories anymore.
Yeah,
they can make confusing stories, just not interesting.
They are the masters of that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you know, I still like 8, even though it was confusing at the end. I still liked it.
And that's the great thing about Bravely Default. All I need to know is you gotta save 4 crystals. Bad guys are trying to stop them. That's it. You don't need anything more than that. I don't need, you know, about gods, and I don't even know what the hell happened in Final Fantasy 12. Some judges and empires, and I don't know.
And the sad thing is, even if you know you read an analysis of it that makes it not confusing, it doesn't make it more interesting. Mm-hmm. I wish that it was like, if only I understood this, then it would be so great. No,
right.
It is confusing, and then when you finally do get it, you're like, oh, well, that was just confusing for confusing's sake.
Mm-hmm. I think they get too sucked in by their own lore, because I think like every time they make a Final Fantasy, like numeric series, they make their own lore in terms of the
a new
world beginning myth and ending myth they had to create.
Yeah,
and I feel like they get stuck up their own butts a little too much, and like there's no. I feel like they write in a bubble. Like there's just no censor. So like, it sounds great. What this 5 gods to make this? All right, perfect. Go for it.
I kind of feel sorry for the guy who actually has to sit there and come up with a new world for every Final Fantasy game. He could just have like a dartboard of like different concepts.
Yeah, they're like, all right, girlish, feminine characters / male characters. Go. All right, put him with a bunch of other whiny archetypes. Go.
Amnesia,
the world's going to destroy itself. Amnesia, go. Perfect. Mm-hmm. Perfect. 5
now
stars.
Now we just need 80 hours of cutscene and we're done.
Make sure you pad it. Mm-hmm. Tons.
Okay. All right, with that, let's move on to some other games. Charles, have you been playing any interesting games?
I've been playing some oldies but goodies. I'm still playing Awesome Knots a lot. You know, it's the 2D platformer MOBA League of Legends style. Mm-hmm. And I've been playing some Borderlands 2.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Borderlands, I think. Have they officially wrapped up their DLC, or is there still one more coming?
I think there's one more coming that's not out yet.
Cool.
How do you feel about Telltale's Borderlands 2 game?
I haven't played it. You know, I know that they're great at what they do. Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. I mean, I in general trust them and what they do. I'm not excited about it, even though I really like Borderlands games.
Yeah.
It's hard to get excited about it.
Yeah, I think the problem for me is that Borderlands is such a gameplay-focused series that Telltale has shown that they are moving away from gameplay. They're more about storytelling and narrative. So it seems like such a weird fit. You know, like are the first-person or role-playing shooter fans of Borderlands going to enjoy a slow narrative game like The Wolf Among Us or The Walking Dead?
I don't know. That's a hard thing to... That's why I think people are very interested to see what's going to happen, because you're right, there is that weird dichotomy going on.
Yeah, I mean, they've shown that they're great at taking a TV graphic novel franchise like Walking Dead and making that really work in their kind of gameplay, which is a gameplay that's, it's focused on narrative. It's more of a narrative experience than it is a game. You're not going to, like, get good at it. What would that even mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I agree. I mean, what excites me about a Borderlands game session is like loot, finding loot and new ways to play, co-op action. I like the stories there to hold it together and give me some motivation, but it's totally not why I play.
Yeah, I mean, they've done some interesting things with like the narrative with like the DLC context, but it's still nowhere like the hook of the game. I mean, the hook is obviously more guns, more skills, and, you know, just go from there.
Yeah.
Right. There is a lot of interesting lore to the series that they could explore. Mm-hmm. But again, we'll see, because again, it's all about action, right? Because you do kind of let it all kind of fade mm-hmm. in the background you're playing. The only thing you really pay attention to is the taunting of Jack, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think what it makes me think of that reminds me of Lightning Returns is I think Telltale makes great adventure story games, but they're making one for Borderlands, and I don't play Borderlands for its story. I hear that the action gameplay of Lightning Returns is great, but I don't play Final Fantasy games at all anymore. But I, when I do, I don't play them for their like really exciting gameplay innovations. I often do play for their story and for the role-playing elements over a long period of time. So I think that something that's tricky for franchises like this to do is defy those expectations and try to make a Borderlands game that focuses on narrative choices and try to make a Final Fantasy game that focuses on like action gameplay. Whenever you do that, you're probably going to get skeptical consumers who are like, ah, you know, I love action gameplay, but I don't know if I want, like, I really don't like Lightning and I don't think she's interesting. So now I'm not interested in playing it.
Oh yeah, by the way, in the Final Fantasy 13, I mean, Lightning Returns game, they take, for some reason, something happened to her where they took her emotion out. She was even more bland than before.
Perfect.
I know. They took her emotion out, and she's just like, I'm here for a mission.
She was way too interesting before, you know? I know. So I'm really glad they toned that down.
Toned it down. Took the emotion out of her. Now she's pretty much a robot that can change outfits.
Because honestly, I would prefer a robot that changed outfits. I'd prefer a whole new franchise there. Like, if they've got some great gameplay, don't staple that on to a dying franchise that nobody's interested in.
My theory is that they made so much money. They spent so much money. Like, we have to reuse these assets. We have to make a profit. That's what's happening. Okay. We spent so much money on environments. You got to redo it.
All right. So let's move on. And Cam, what game have you been playing?
I just finished Deponia, which is an adventure game by Dadalic Entertainment. Mm-hmm. And they make a lot of great, like, really beautiful adventure games. But, man, is this adventure game so archaic? It is, though it looks cool and the writing's really funny, it's still very adventure gamey. It's about this guy who lives on a trash planet, and he's kind of like a Han Solo. He's kind of like a scoundrel with a kind of a good heart, but mostly self-centered, egotistical jerk. And he's trying to get to a special place in the sky called Elysium, and that's where all the rich upper class live, while everyone that lives on the trash planet is called Deponia. And I guess he stumbles upon a conspiracy to destroy Deponia. And it's a lot of fun to be had. And the art is really cool, and the animation's really fluid. It's just that the puzzles are so... They are, like, right in the thick of, like, the heyday of adventure games, where you have to add this and this. Like, the logic doesn't fit. It's so far from reality. I had to play the game through a walkthrough. I need a walkthrough to play the game.
And that's the thing that I think I talked with Dave Gilbert about last week, with how a lot of these older adventure games just... Or once today, they're trying to build off that nostalgia. Let's just create these insane puzzles that make no sense. And
darn it. I wanted to ask him about that stupid puzzle with the wind in the dorm room. That was the worst.
Yeah, he actually had a funny story where he was at a conference where he talked about how much he hated that puzzle, and then some of the audience was arguing against him, saying, oh, it was a great puzzle.
No, the worst puzzle. The worst puzzle. I hated it. All the puzzles in the dorm room were terrible. I hated them all.
And as a funny aside, I've been playing the adventure game from Watch I called the Shiva. I was playing late last night, so I have all the Yiddish terms still stuck in my head.
Right.
And it's kind of weird. I think this was one of his first adventure games.
It's his very first.
It's short, but it had like some interesting ideas with like the narrative. Like, you have, for some reason, you're a rabbi that you basically have to solve a murder mystery. And you can basically you have the nice response, the nasty response, and you have the rabbi response, which is you basically answer a question with a question. You can do that for every conversation in the game.
That sounds awesome, actually.
And you actually have to get into a rabbi fight with another rabbi at one point, which is just hilarious.
Yeah, I really love all the budget guy games, and I'm kind of sad to hear that Black will be wrapping up in March with Epiphany. Yeah. Though she has a scarf in it, so that's cool.
So I think with that, we can move on to our final topic then for the cast, and that is on the subject of free-to-play. Last week, Pierre Molyneux, in an interview, I think, with Pocket Gamer, he talked about how Goddess is going to be designed around monetization, which he doesn't want to call it free-to-play because of all the negative connotations with that, and, you know, after Dungeon Keeper just sucking horribly. So he wants to basically redefine free-to-play, you know, typical, you know, Pierre Molyneux speak, and wants to call it investable. And it sounds, you know, very crazy at first, but I do think he has one interesting point with that, and that's how free-to-play has become this all-encompassing term for any game with monetization. And this has led to a branding problem, because you got games like Card Hunter, League of Legends, Team Fortress, who are sharing the same space as Candy Crush Saga, Farmville, and any other, you know, heavily monetized game that you can think of. And this is an interesting point that previous guests Chris Gardner and Joe McDonough made about when they're trying to make free-to-play games, and people, the second they hear the term free-to-play, they go, you know, no, you know, I don't want to play a game that's going to try to suck all my money out. Those are horrible. And they won't even give it a first look. So the idea is interesting to essentially rebrand free-to-play games, but at the same time, I'm not so sure we could even do that or even like the right ways to go about that. So what do you guys think about that?
Well, firstly, calling it invest-to-play is the wrong direction. Mm-hmm. That sounds like a very negative terminology.
It sounds like even more monetization, I think.
Yeah, exactly. I do think it's a good idea to specify within it, because you can think of free-to-play as a genre, like a big mm-hmm. umbrella term. Mm-hmm. But because it's gotten so huge, maybe we should have something within it, you know, like maybe we should have casual free to play and action, I don't know, or something like that. Mm-hmm. Just break it down to even more minute details.
Okay. What do you think, Charles?
Well, I feel like I hate to get on the Manya hate train, but he often brings up new ideas, like, right, this is some sort of industry shakeup new idea, but with no substance behind it. Mm-hmm. He doesn't say what he even means by invest to play. Yeah. Or what that would, is that a change in a monetization structure? That could be really interesting, but there's just no detail. And this is not the first time this has happened. This is his track record showing itself again. Yeah. He needs to wait to say stuff like this until he can actually substantiate it with some difference and say, here's how free-to-play has always worked. And here's why people don't like it, especially core gamers that I make games for. And I think you can take parts of that model and apply it in a new way that I'm calling invest-to-play, and here's how it works. Or, you will never hear him say that.
Or better yet, or here's another thing we'll never see him do, is actually have an example ready when he says it. Because
yeah,
he's talking about Goddess being, you know, going to have this big change in monetization, but there hasn't been an update to Goddess in, I think, 3, maybe 4 months. And people are generally pissed off that there's been no contact or no feedback from 22 Cans about the state of the game.
Yeah, that's just not okay. you gotta, I think it's okay to not have an update in a while. Sometimes you gotta work really hard on a big one that's coming out, but you gotta be in contact with your backers, especially when you're a Kickstarter project like Goddess was.
Mm-hmm. And we talked about this before the cast, but you've been keeping your Kickstarter pledges pretty much updated over the sale of Artisans, right?
Yeah, we have an update. You know, sometimes we have an update every week. Sometimes we go a month and a half without one. And our backers keep us honest. They'll send us a message or a comment and say, hey, where's the next update? And we'll respond back publicly on our comment thread to say what we've been working on, what problems we've been running into. It's hard. Sometimes you want to just be radio silent and put your nose down and work on your game. But I think when you've taken Kickstarter money, you do have to embrace that culture of that community and be responsible to them. So yeah, that's a shame that he's talking about this invest to play, but at the same time, not actually talking to his community.
Yep, it's that really big change in terms of game development. I mean, traditionally, a studio could go, you know, months, even years, just working on a game, and they may not even announce they're even working on something until, you know, maybe a month or 2 months it's going to come out. But that's when you have publisher money, where you can just sit and work on a game by yourself for months and months on end. But as you said with Kickstarter, these people already gave you their money, and they're expecting, you know, updates. They want to know what's going on. They don't want to see their money basically being, you know, thrown out the window.
Right. And I think the connection between your base and your developer is very important. And then, by the way, I have seen a lot of the Artisan updates, and you are really responsive. And that's really nice. And I think that gives people more faith within developers.
Yeah, a lot of it is about faith. And I think that's what makes this difficult with Molyneux's quotes is I don't have much faith that there is substance behind what he's saying. I think there's definitely a vision and an idealistic idea. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe even he himself isn't sure what he means when he says these things, but he just knows that he's got this gut feeling, which I agree with, that like free to play has a bad rap in general amongst his core audience. And yet there's some examples of it, like League of Legends, that even the core audience is actually totally fine with and actually likes. Team Fortress 2 and Hearthstone are doing very well and are free to play. So he's thinking like there must be some distinction between these. And is it, you know, would a name change make that distinction clear for customers? Or are there actually substantive differences between the two? And so, yeah, who cares what the name is? We could change it, but that we're not doing free to play in the same ways. We're giving it a blanket term, but the different business models maybe deserve different names.
You know, calling it free to play and then call it something mobile free to play could make a big difference. Because as soon as you put the word mobile in front of any kind of game, people have certain expectations. And that's what they kind of relate what free-to-play actually is, right? So yeah. that could be helpful in delineation right there. If someone said this is free-to-play and this is free-to-play mobile.
I also wonder, is this a problem that actually exists? Can we think of examples of games that we heard were free-to-play and we then said, nah, I don't want to play it anymore? It used to look good. I was interested until I found out it was free-to-play.
I think for like most of like the hardcore gamers are the ones who are educated on design. I don't think there's a problem there because they generally do the research and they can see, you know, when a game is trying to sell them crap and when they're trying to make a legitimately good game. But when you look at like general gamers or casual gamers, I mean, I've, you know, looked at forums and messages before, and there are people who, the second you say something's free to play or it has a microtransaction, they're like, no, I don't want to play it. It's going to, you know, rip me off and all that stuff. So there is that negative connotation mm-hmm. around free to play out there.
Yeah, let's talk briefly about Deep Down mm-hmm. because we praise Dark Souls. We're all excited about it. And Deep Down kind of looks like a Dark Souls ripoff a little bit, and it's free to play. Mm-hmm. And has that changed the way we think about that game and are excited for it? Do you know much about it? It's Capcom's dungeon crawler.
What?
Too much.
It's called Deep Down, right?
Yeah, Deep Down. It's supposedly, here's sort of the premise. It's set in modern day New York, but in some way that we don't know yet, you don medieval armor and you go into an infinitely random dungeon that looks very much like Dark Souls, plays very much like Dark Souls, and that somehow this whole thing that looks like a traditional Capcom third-person action game is free to play, which was very surprising to me. A console free to play third person action game from Capcom. What?
Yeah, those words don't seem to mix.
Those don't mix.
To me, it kind of scares me because one of the worst offenders of microtrans in the Japanese industry is Capcom, right?
Yeah,
people that do it wrong, it's them all the way. So for them to say that gives me not much hope for this game, or at least pushes me away from it.
Right, because we start to imagine if it's free to play, that must mean some things. Like, I'm going to have to be buying loot, not earning loot. I'm going to have to either excessively grind for some achievement that I could just purchase, or like, where are they going to get me, right? I would rather probably drop even $60 to play a great game than to like, you know, in Dark Souls, there's death hiding around any corner and dangers everywhere. And then deep down, it might be like, a pay gate is lurking around every corner. You never know when they're going to like grab your wallet.
And I think that's exactly what the psychology behind it is. When someone hears microtrans, they feel like in some way the game's trying to manipulate them. It's like hidden. It just makes you paranoid. Mm-hmm.
That's ironic.
or you have to give them concessions, right? Because you're like, well, I didn't pay any money to play this game. So when it gives me that, do you want to buy this? I'll just accept it and move on. You know, that kind of thing too.
Yeah.
I feel like the other. Either you play and you give it concessions, or you just don't want to play it because you feel like you're going to be manipulated.
Mm-hmm. Well, Molyneux's expression, invest to play, I find either it is ironic, or actually he chose that specifically because I think investment is the issue with free to play. With Deep Down, let's say I pick it up and play a bit, because I've paid nothing, if I even run into a slight thing that I don't like, I'm going to give it up because I am not invested at all. I literally have made no investment. I haven't paid any money. But for those people who suffered through the first 20 hours of Final Fantasy 13, in part they do it because they're like, well, I already own the game. I mean, might as well play it. And in free-to-play, that just doesn't happen. We give up a lot faster. So invest to play seems like a cart before the horse. I play because I'm already invested. I won't invest in order to play, and I won't make investments after that.
You know, I think the free to plays that get me the most, that are most effective, are the ones that have the giant, like, social aspect to it, like League of Legends and Team Fortress. Because, you know, because everyone else kind of indulges, you kind of feel like you want to indulge too. And everyone has their own, like, obsession with what their avatar looks like, or what they're playing, or something that makes you look unique compared to other players. I think that even though it's being exploited, because you're all indulging it together, it feels like it's easier to stomach.
Yeah, I think you're right. So deep down could work if it had some of that social element, perhaps, or it had a very, I think also simplicity helps. If we're worried about the pay gates lurking behind corners and we're not sure what's going to be free and what they're going to charge for, or like in Candy Crush, they actually essentially stop you from playing after a while and you can pay money to keep playing. We worry about stuff like that because that's just sort of inherently unfun. But something like League where, I feel like some of the simplicity of the business model, I know you can pay for a lot of things in League, but I think of it as I can pay for characters if I want to. I have a small selection of free characters, and if I want to own one of them and always have it available, I can pay money. Like, I can really wrap my head around that. I find it simple. And if I want to play matches, there's nothing in there that, like, paying money is going to make me better than someone else.
Yep, and that's a really good point. And that's the fear that a lot of people have with free-to-play games is, you know, if there's a competitive aspect to it, what's to stop someone from just spending $20-$30 and they become unstoppable for a month or whatever?
Well, yeah.
That's like the base rule in game design is not, if it's, any multiplayer game has to be fair. And anything that you create, you know, art-wise should be cosmetic only. You don't pay to win. This isn't, because if that's the case, that's a guaranteed way to kill your community, you know?
And yet a lot of games choose to do it.
And then they kill their community.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah, but it's basically short-term benefits versus, you know, the long-term death of your game.
It's the dark side.
What's that EVE first-person shooter, Dust something, 513 or something like that?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
And it, you know, it has consumables, which some are very objectively better than others, and you can shell out money, but you're only objectively better for like one life until your equipment breaks. How do you guys feel about that? Is that kind of, I don't know how well they're doing, but I was definitely turned off just by consumables in general and breakable stuff. Yeah. I like more persistence than that, but
I'm the same way. And I think I wrote a post about this already. That to me, I think that's a difference in psychology among mobile games and like PC game fans. For like the PC audience, I think we like things that have substance, that have content. That when I spend $5 or $10 or whatever, I know I'm getting something for my money. Not something that's going to be there for, you know, an hour, you know, until I die. And then, you know, I have to keep buying it and so on.
Right. I want it to be permanent. Mm-hmm. If I'm going to pick that bunch of investment, I want it to be permanent.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And it'll be interesting to see how that that goes. I think what Molyneux should do with Goddess, I don't know if he's already done this, but when you're going to be free to play or invest to play, whatever you choose to call it, you got to be crystal clear what it is that can be purchased, and to not make that hidden or secret. If that's tends to be our greatest fear is, we know it's not true. It's not free to play. It's there are things that do need to be purchased, and if you don't purchase them, you will pay some sort of price, whether that's time or inconvenience or frustration.
You know, I feel like invest to play is more of a term for early access games. I feel like they're more invest to play.
Totally.
Yeah. Free to play, if you think about it.
Mm-hmm. And speaking about invest to play, probably a good example of a game like that would be Star Citizen, which is the... I think it's being developed by the guy who helped make the Wing Commander series. It's a spaceship simulator. And what they're doing with it is that they had a Kickstarter, it succeeded, and now, as they're developing, it's going to be like this massive, grand universe MMO spaceship simulator game that they have additional funding goals that they keep having that will basically add new content and new stuff to the game. So right now, they actually have a $40 million stretch goal. And it's already 27% close to being done. So they've been doing this since, according to their site, since January of 2012, that they've been keep adding more stretch goals to it. And so who knows how far they're really going to go with that. But I think this raises another concern, is could either of you play a game that continuously asks for money? Something that's like every month they say, oh, if we get $2,000 more of funding, we're going to add a new level. If we add, you know, $7,000 this month, we're going to add new character designs and whatever.
I could do that. I can see myself doing that only if I was essentially obsessed with the game. You know, like yeah. I love Monster Hunter, and that is one franchise where I really wish that they would say, hey, we want to fund a new monster. Mm-hmm. If we raise X amount of dollars, you'll get this monster. We'll show you how it works. Mm-hmm. I would actually do that for them. But, you know, I don't know if I would be turned off going into a new franchise that I've never played if they told me that that's how they're going to expand over time. They're going to start with very limited content. I think it's an easier ask once you've got this established fan base.
In the case of what Kickstarter does, it gives you a fan base. So there you go. Makes
true.
Sense.
True.
That's one of the hardest things to get. So I think even though there is that negative, I guess the connotation of stress about having to answer your backers, but you have backers. That's the beautiful part of it. You don't just set a game out in the blue and have to form and do marketing and grab all these people. You just already have them.
Yeah. They are a lot easier to reach.
Yeah, and they're also big, big fans of you already from the get-go. They feel invested too. You're invested in them, and they're invested in you. Mm-hmm. So,
but I think there's also the worry of stretch goals, and this is something that we've talked to previous guests about, and how if you start putting in all these different stretch goals and all these options, one, it just raises your development time dramatically, and two, it can annoy people who feel like you're basically, you know, holding out on them. Here's the basic game, and we're only going to do this, but, you know, give us $20,000 more and we'll make it, you know, 30% more better and 20% more faster and all that stuff.
I think clarity is the most important part. Mm-hmm. You need to be clear with them to make sure they don't feel they're being ripped off. If you really think that the stretch goal is appropriate and it's fair, mm-hmm. and it really will cost that much money, you have to tell your audience the same thing. And if they really are devoted and they are, you know, your fans or investors, they're going to believe you, and they're, unless you've been lying to them the whole time. Unless you're Pierre Molyneux, it's different. I'm not saying he's a big liar, but he makes some lofty promises that never come through.
Yeah.
And that's a good point about trying to explain to someone what the cost of something is. I'm looking at the Star Citizen funding page, and every $1 million, they have another goal. But they don't really explain exactly, you know, why is this costing that much? Why does it cost $1 million to add a new star system or one new class of ships? Now, it could, of course, cost that much, but, you know, we'll never know what that means.
Well, I mean, that's true. I think that'd be a bit more fair, but they are making their money, so there you go.
Yep, they are at the time of this podcast, $39,273,880.
Holy moly. That's a crazy Kickstarter amount. Well, it's not really Kickstarter anymore, but...
Yeah, it was only $2 million from Kickstarter.
And it's still going. I have no idea when this game's actually going to come out.
I heard people just get stuck in the game, but that's just me. There's like so far they can get, and then they're just done. They can't get any farther. They start again.
Well, apparently, if they get $41 million, they'll have a procedural generation R&D team whose job is just to create procedural generated content.
Wait, where is Star Citizen? How far along in that? Don't they also have the same kind of model with money being funneled to them? Or is it not clear how much money is being funneled to them? Because that is another really lofty game that is still getting money.
Well, Star Citizen, they do have, they're showing exactly what they've unlocked and how much money they have and what their future goals are, but I don't know how many actual goals they have. Like, are they just going to keep adding stretch goals at some point?
I guess. I mean, it makes sense. If they're still asking for money, they're going to keep asking for stretch goals.
Yeah, it's interesting. At some point, isn't it just people are purchasing Star Citizen and it's not funding additional goals? You know, if I go out and buy another copy of World of Warcraft, they don't say, oh, sweet, now we're going to finally reach that another stretch goal for World of Warcraft. No, I'm just buying the game.
Right. I don't know. maybe people are easier for them to donate. They just had that charity in their heart. I don't know.
I think definitely the nostalgic factor is there, because the spaceship simulator genre has really, you know, dried up. It's probably even more
I feel like
the
it's...
adventure genre.
But it's taking off again. Puns. I feel it is. I feel there's a lot of games with the simulations and spaceship stuff going on that have been very successful. FTL, Kerbal Space Program, even Star Citizen, like they're all these amazing things that are coming out. And don't forget, hey, those another reason I'm interested in Star Citizen is their support for Oculus. They're one of the first that supports Oculus.
Seems like a good fit.
You can walk around your cockpit and look at things with your Oculus. You can do it. I haven't tried it yet, but I'm going to with the new version, the consumer version of the Rift.
Very cool.
All right. I think that's just about everything that I have to say on the topic. Do you guys have anything you want to bring up about free-to-play or invest-to-play?
Find a better term for invest-to-play, and that's about it.
I don't think it needs a new term. I think clarity. You know, you're not free to play. You're charging money for something, and if you're not paying money, you're paying with something else. So just be clear about your business model, I think.
Yeah.
And one last thing that I just thought of, I think the other problem with, you know, trying to make this grand change of brand is that what happens when all the, you know, sleazier and heavily monetized games switch as well? Then, you know, we're just trading one crappy term for another crappy term. Like, if this is going to work, there needs to be, you know, like, an actual set of guidelines. And someone has to, you know, sit there and, you know, judge and define, you know, this is what an invest-to-play game or this is whatever the hell it's going to be.
Just do this free-to-play browser, free-to-play, free-to-play browser, free-to-play mobile. Mm-hmm. There you go. Separated that way.
Yep. Well, we shall see. And maybe in the next few months, Goddess will wow us. Maybe Star Citizen will...
No.
Spoiler alert, no.
That's mean. I'm sorry, Peter Molyneux.
Well, he's not going to be on the cast now. Thanks.
I'm sorry.
All right, so I think with that, we can wrap things up. Do you guys have any final thoughts just for the cast in general?
Nope.
No, I've said all I have to say.
Yep, my throat is sufficiently parched as well.
Check out Artisan.
Yep.
There you go.
Done. All right.
I helped.
Yay!
Alright, so I think with that said, we can wrap things up for the cast this week. Charles, again, it was great having you on, and I can't wait to see Artisans. And you said that it's going to be at PAX Prime this year?
That's what we're hoping.
What about PAX East?
That is too soon.
No, I'm going to go to PAX East. I wanted to see you guys. I wanted to high-five you guys there.
Oh, man. Now, we're shooting for PAX Prime, which is probably going to be in the end of August. It hasn't been announced yet, though.
Buy your tickets early. They sold PAX East, sold out in 35 minutes.
I know. It's getting crazy. They need more conventions.
They actually said that it was actually scalpers that were buying most of the tickets. It's messed up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. And Kent, it was great talking to you as well.
Mm-hmm. No problem.
All right. So with that said, thank you for tuning in to the Perceptive Podcast this week. As always, if you would like to contribute to Game Wisdom, either by writing a piece for the site or by being a guest on a future cast, feel free to send me an email. You can find all the links and information under Submissions Wanted on the front page. With that said, have a great weekend, and we will talk to you again next week. Take care, everybody.
Good night.